The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, We Need Supply-Side Education Policy, written by David Deming. On Wednesday night, in a speech in Pennsylvania, Kamala Harris announced that, if elected, she would eliminate degree requirements for hundreds of thousands of federal jobs. And, she added, she would challenge the private sector to make a similar commitment. This policy, often called skills-based hiring, is very popular with voters, which explains why Harris made a similar promise earlier this month. The Trump administration also tried to loosen degree requirements in federal hiring with an executive order, making it the rare policy that draws bipartisan support. Little seems to have come of that order, which was issued right before the 2020 election. Nearly 60% of adults ages 25 to 29 do not have a bachelor's degree. If they have the skills to do a certain job, why should they be denied the chance solely because they lack a somewhat arbitrary paper credential? And yet, despite its popularity, skills-based hiring is a dead-end policy. If every employer in America formally stopped requiring a four-year college degree for every available position as of tomorrow, nothing much would change. Indeed, companies such as Walmart, Apple, and many others have proudly touted their removal of degree requirements in job postings. But the net effect on hiring has been very small. A recent Harvard Business School study found that when companies remove degree requirements, the share of hires with a bachelor's degree declines by only 2 percentage points. Employers may not insist on a college degree, but they still prefer it. So even if a degree isn't formally required, applicants who have one will still usually beat out applicants who don't, because employers need some way to differentiate between them. The real issue, in other words, is not the existence of degree requirements, but the lack of alternative ways for workers to prove their qualifications. If political leaders really want to expand opportunities for non-college-educated Americans, that's the problem they need to solve. Doing so is not a particularly complicated, but it will require the government to make a markedly different approach to higher education than it is accustomed to. The proposal to remove degree requirements fits into a larger historical pattern of higher education and workforce development policy, particularly within the Democratic Party. Both the Obama and Biden administrations increased the generosity of the Pell Grant for low-income students, forgave some student loans, and increased transparency in reporting college graduates' outcomes. The Bipartisan Workforce Pell Act, working its way through Congress, would expand students' ability to use federal financial aid for non-degree training programs. These are all demand-side policies, meaning they seek to change incentives through prices, subsidies, and regulations. What we're missing is supply-side policy for career and technical education. The U.S. spends a paltry 0.03% of GDP on job training, compared with an average of 0.11% across other advanced economies. The absence of credible non-degree pathways leads to a lack of interest in the skilled trades among young people, which in turn creates shortages in necessary professions such as plumbing. Adjusting the knobs on the demand side dials won't work because what we really need doesn't yet exist. Why do employers hire college graduates for entry-level jobs in the first place? Recent grads don't typically have much practical knowledge, but being admitted to college and finishing a four-year program of study at least signals that a graduate has some measure of talent and grit. This helps explain why the college wage premium starts small but grows quickly as workers gain experience. Companies hire untested college graduates in the hopes that their investment will pay off over time. Most employers would prefer a worker who can be productive right away, which explains the theoretical appeal of skilled-based hiring. The problem is that skills are hard to verify. Companies know their employees' capabilities but have no incentive to share that knowledge with rivals who would use it to steal the good workers away. The Harvard economist Amanda Pallais has shown that entry-level workers benefit from having information about their capabilities shared publicly with the labor market. Sub-baccalaureate credentials, unfortunately, do not send a very clear signal either, because they vary widely and present a confusing patchwork of options to employers. Fixing that problem would expand opportunities for Americans without a college diploma much more than eliminating degree requirements would. To give just one example, consider credentialing for cardiovascular technicians. At Bunker Hill Community College in Boston, for instance, you can enroll in a full-time two-year program to earn your associate's degree in cardiac sonography. At Hudson Valley Community College in Troy, New York, you can obtain a one-year certificate, in cardiac sonography, but only after you've completed either an associate's degree in another health-related field or a bachelor's degree in an unrelated discipline. Meanwhile, many community colleges in both states don't even offer specific cardiovascular tech programs, opting instead to provide general, quote, allied health, end quote, degrees, and leaving the specific training to employers. The variation across colleges means employers don't know what they are getting. A cardiovascular technician with a certificate from HVCC might be able to get a job in Troy, where local employers understand her qualifications. But if she wants to get a better job at a hospital in Boston, she has no way of demonstrating that her certificate has any value. This limits her mobility and, in turn, her career prospects. Switching employers is a crucial part of wage growth. A big advantage of a bachelor's degree is that you can take it anywhere. Vice President Harris has spoken favorably about expanding apprenticeship programs, which combine paid on-the-job training with classroom instruction. Apprenticeships work. A careful evaluation of the federally funded registered apprenticeship program found that it produced substantial earnings gains, but they are custom-made and expensive. In 2021, the most recent year for which data were available, more than 25,000 active programs served as an average of fewer than 10 apprentices each. A more scalable model is the Fast Forward program, which has funded career-oriented training for almost 45,000 learners in 23 community colleges across Virginia. As part of the program, the state community college system has created career maps in fields such as manufacturing and health sciences, with a common curriculum that allows people to obtain advanced credentials that build on one another or stack, and opens doors to better paying jobs. An early evaluation of Fast Forward found that enrolled students who received an industry-recognized credential saw increased earnings of about $4,000 per year. Congress could do something similar on a national scale by creating and funding a federal certification program for career pathways in fields with high job demand and good prospects for upward mobility, such as advanced manufacturing and cardiovascular technology. Federal standards would create common quality benchmarks and a shared language around the skills required for career success in each field. This would make factories and hospitals across the country more willing to hire graduates from out-of-state programs because they would know what they are getting. It would also be easier to stack credentials across different sectors, which would give workers greater career mobility. Building better pathways for career and technical education in the U.S. requires institution building rather than market-based reforms, much like the Biden administration's approach in areas such as infrastructure investment and clean energy. Cities and states should be able to tailor career and technical education to the strengths of the local economy, but only the federal government can provide the nationwide credibility and the funding to create more good jobs for a majority of Americans who do not have four-year degrees. Our second article, Stop Believing in Free Shipping by Amanda Mall. This was actually written in the January-February 2020 issue of The Atlantic. It was a pair of feather earrings that helped Anne Maselli get out from underneath strangers' cars. For years, Maselli had worked as an auto mechanic and picked up shifts in her spare time at Indianapolis restaurants. One day, she came across those earrings, and it kind of sparked something. Maselli bought a pair and then some samples to make her own. She listed some of her creations in a shop on Etsy and named it Pretty Vagrant. That was in 2011. In the intervening years, Maselli has sold nearly 30,000 of her handmade earrings and feather hair extensions, all of which she assembles by hand at home. After a couple of years, Maselli quit her job as a mechanic. Etsy has given me the opportunity to work from home and watch my grandkids, she told me. Everything was humming along nicely until last summer, when the site began implementing a new search algorithm that gives priority to sellers who guarantee free shipping. Those who charged even a few dollars, like Maselli, were removed from their spots on the first page of search results. In August, Maselli's revenue was down 40% from the previous year, a huge dip that she blames on the free shipping finagling. Etsy says it had no choice. Buyers' expectations had changed, and it felt compelled to respond. The company told Maselli to raise her prices to compensate for and disguise shipping fees. But when Maselli looked around, her competitors seemed to be simply eating the cost, which she couldn't afford to do. Etsy and Maselli share the same goal, to induce shoppers to buy from Etsy instead of ordering mass-produced goods from some unaccountable conventional retailers that would like to ship you a pair of feather earrings. Now she and her platform are in conflict because of how those other retailers, especially Amazon, have warped our idea of what it means to shop online. There's scarcely tastier bait for American shoppers than free shipping, and it's been transformed from an occasional incentive into something that closely resembles a consumer requirement. But shipping isn't free for the people who send packages, and an insatiable demand for this perk might be the thing that breaks up mom-and-pop retail for good. Online shipping, when it works best, is sort of like a duck. The part above the water, the algorithmically selected products, the simple checkout process, aided by personal information stored on phones, the package that appears on your porch 2 days later, glides placidly along, setting off only the gentlest of ripples to your attention. The apotheosis of e-commerce is when people send money without feeling like anything has happened at all. Below the surface, the little webbed feet of retail paddle furiously. Maselli alone takes a new bundle of packages to the post office nearly every day. This holiday season, the United States Postal Service will deliver a projected 800 million packages. Early in 2020, FedEx started delivering on Sundays all year, a service previously reserved for the holidays. In New York, where daily deliveries have tripled in less than a decade, trucks snarl streets and rack up nearly 500,000 parking tickets annually. In 2015, Amazon launched Amazon Flex, through which the company pays people to use their own cars to ferry boxes, assuming all responsibility for mileage and expenses. Large retailers make sure their own ducks stay upright. Orders come in boxes marked with the insignia of the seller, not the deliverer. Narvar, a popular logistics startup that touts its ability to help brands deliver premium post-purchase experiences, directs buyers to a clean, bright retail marked landing page to track packages. If you don't look closely, you might think Warby Parker itself is bringing you your new glasses, not UPS. Masking the nitty-gritty of shipping, namely the costs, is the most potent tool online stores have to persuade people to click a place order and to come back for more. In a 2018 survey by internet retailer, shipping charges were cited as the most common reason shoppers abandon their carts, topping the pet peeve list for nearly a third of respondents, ahead of things like not wanting to create an account and being unsure of the store's return policy. Many resent paying for shipping so much that they'll buy more expensive items or throw in additional small stuff just to clear a free delivery purchase minimum, says Ron Berman, a marketing professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. At Etsy's suggestion, Mycelli started using a similar gambit, absorbing the cost for orders over $35 in hopes of people buying her at least expensive products would buy more of them. Free shipping is enticing, says Ravi Dahar, the director of Yale Center of Consumer Insights, because shoppers irrationally hate to pay for certain services, even those they value immensely, such as speedy and reliable delivery. This demonstrates the economic principle known as pain of paying, a psychological discomfort that keeps people from completing purchases. Certain factors seem to sharpen the pain. Using cash rather than credit card typically hurts more because paper money must be physically relinquished. Higher charges for convenience, such as the jacked-up price for a soda in a hotel minibar or closer parking at a sporting event, usually rankle too. Printer ink and hotel Wi-Fi torment because they're means to an end that consumers feel they're already paid to reach. You bought the printer, of course you need to print things. You booked the hotel, of course you need to check your email during your stay. Paying for shipping is a two-for-one pain deal. Not only are you confronted with the actual cost of your convenience, but you're being asked to pay extra for a store to fork over items you've already laid out for. It wasn't always like this in America, and it's not like this in most other countries. Standard European shipping and return policies would probably seem downright hostile here. That's because U.S. shoppers are used to being coaxed into purchases by retailers who can and will bend over backward to land a sale. Another example of capitalism American style. The main reason small businesses can't keep up with the behemoths is economies of scale. Thanks to their huge infrastructure, mega retailers simply pay less per package for shipping. Scale also helps when it comes to an ever more popular companion to free shipping, free returns. There's another salve for the pain of paying, but processing returns requires manpower and eats into profits. Big clothing retailers can recoup some of the costs of by offloading returns and stale inventory to discount stores. Dahr and Berman point to the dot-com boom as the moment when retailers, fed by investor dollars and under no pressure to turn a profit, started offering free shipping to get people to take a chance on companies they'd never, ever heard of. Webvan and Zappos, an online shoe store, helped normalize the incentive. Venture capital still drives much of the free shipping expectation for the same reason it did in the beginning. Getting people to try something new can be difficult. What got us to the present is Amazon Prime, the $119 annual program with more than 100 million American members, which promises unlimited two-day shipping to almost anywhere in the United States. The trick Amazon pulled off was to divorce shipping costs almost entirely from individual buying behavior by charging an annual shipping fee, then further camouflaging matters by making video streaming services and the like part of the package. Now we think nothing we order online should take more than 2 days to arrive. The company is in the process of shaving a day off that expectation. This is what Etsy's 2.6 million customers, mostly women, mostly one-person operations, according to the company, are up against. One, on internal forums, they've been voicing concerns about lost sales, reduced margin, and the inability to keep up with Jeff Bezos and the Waltons. So far, the free shipping push hasn't been a big win for Etsy either. In an earnings call in October, the company's executive said that although the number of listings offering free shipping had more than doubled to just over 60%, the conversion rate, the percentage of visitors to the site who actually buy something, had fallen. Popular sellers like Micelli had worked their way to the front page because buyers liked them, and now they were harder to find. But as more and more of the vendors get with the new regime, Etsy expects to see its performance rebound. As for Micelli, her sales have started to tick back up from their crater, but she's still not where she was. In the meantime, she's picking up shifts at local restaurants and friends' bars, a plan B that she'd work to keep viable in case of the internet unexpectedly evaporates her income. I'm always so nervous. There are so many highs and lows and so much stress, she said. There are people winning. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. I just don't know who those people are. Next, Throw Out Your Black Plastic Spatula by Zoe Schlanger. For the past several years, I've been telling my friends what I'm going to tell you. Throw out your black plastic spatula. In a world of plastic consumer goods, avoiding the material entirely requires the fervor of a religious conversion. But getting rid of black plastic kitchen utensils is a low-stakes move and worth it. Cooking with any plastic is a dubious enterprise because heat encourages potentially harmful plastic compounds to migrate out of the polymers and potentially into the food. But as Andrew Turner, a biochemist at the University of Plymouth, recently told me, black plastic is particularly crucial to avoid. In 2018, Turner published one of the earliest papers positing that black plastic products were likely regularly being made from recycled electronic waste. The clue was the plastic's concerning levels of flame retardants. In some cases, the mix of chemicals matched the profile of those commonly found in computer and television housing, many of which are treated with flame retardants to prevent them from catching fire. Because optical sensors in recycling facilities can't detect them, black-colored plastics are largely rejected from domestic waste streams, resulting in a shortage of black-based material for recycled plastic. So the demand for black plastic appears to be met in no insignificant part by recycled e-waste, according to Turner's research. TV and computer casings tend to be recycled in informal waste economies with few regulations and end up remolded into consumer products, including ones such as spatulas and slotted spoons that come into contact with food. You simply do not want flame retardants anywhere near your stir fry. Flame retardants are typically not bound to the polymers to which they are added, making them a particular flight risk. They dislodge easily and make their way into the surrounding environment. And indeed, another paper from 2018 found that flame retardants in black kitchen utensils readily migrate into hot cooking oil. The health concerns associated with those chemicals are well established. Some flame retardants are endocrine disruptors, which can interfere with the body's hormonal system, and scientific literature suggests they may be associated with a range of ailments, including thyroid disease, diabetes, and cancer. People with the highest blood levels of PBDEs, a class of flame retardants found in black plastic, had about a 300% increase in their risk of dying from cancer, compared with people who had the lowest levels, according to a study released this year. Another food product, black plastic sushi trays, had the highest level of flame retardants in the study. Children's toys also ranked high. A single pirate-themed plastic children's necklace was almost 3% flame retardant by weight. When you're using black plastic items, there's going to be a risk that they could be contaminated, Megan Liu, the science and policy manager at Toxic Free Future and the first author of the study, told me. Those flame retardants migrate into toddlers' saliva and into the dust in our homes and thus in the air we breathe. Last year, Toxic Free Future tested breast milk taken from 50 women in the U.S. and found flame retardant compounds in each sample. Many of the flame retardant compounds that showed up in the test that Liu and her co-authors conducted should no longer be in the product stream. Brominated flame retardants have mostly been phased out of products in the U.S. and Europe, including from many electronics. In the U.S. and elsewhere, some of the most harmful flame retardant compounds are now illegal for use in most consumer products. Massachusetts banned a list of 11 flame retardants in 2021. Starting this year, a New York bill restricts the use of organohalogen flame retardants, one large class of the compounds, in electronic casings, and a similar Washington state ban will go into effect in 2025. But these compounds keep coming back. The sushi tray tested in Liu's study contained 11,900 parts per million of deca-BDE, also called BDE-209, which she described as a really alarming level of a chemical that was banned from most U.S. commerce in 2022 and largely phased out of production long before that. Because plastic recycling is a global economy with scant oversight, patchwork legislation may do little to keep these compounds out of the supply chain. You send your electronic waste abroad and you just haven't got a clue what will happen to it, Turner told me. For a consumer, this product would be simpler to problem would be simpler to handle if it was clear that only certain black plastic products posed a risk, or that all of them did. But Turner found that products were contaminated with flame retardants at random. Not all of the black plastic he tested in his 2018 study contained the compounds, and in those that did, the amount of chemicals in the black plastic varied hugely, he said. Some items would have the same chemical profile of what you'd expect from, say, flame retardant plastic housing of a television or a cell phone. Of the more than 200 black plastic products Liu bought at retail stores for her study, hardly any were labeled with being made from recycled materials, she said. Consumers have no way to tell which plastics might be recycled e-waste and which aren't. It's just a minefield, really, Turner said. Putting your black plastic in the recycling bin might seem like the right thing to do, but recycling isn't a solution to most noxious qualities of plastics. I personally have been throwing out my black plastic takeout containers, Liu told me. In her view, the onus shouldn't fall on consumers to have to make these daily changes in their lives. But that doesn't mean we need to consume them by way of our kitchen utensils. Replacing a black spatula with a steel or silicone option is an easy way to cut down on at least part of one's daily dose of hormone disruptors. I've also taken this news as a reason to coax myself into carrying a reusable coffee mug more often, if only to avoid the black plastic lids on disposable cups. Most of the time, we're trying to navigate without a map, but at least in some areas, we can trace a safer path for ourselves. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.